Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. Elliot Fisher of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare reports on a new technique designed to grow implantable muscle tissue in the lab. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Childhood obesity is a growing problem in this country and in industrialized nations around the world. A third of America's children are obese or overweight, and in spite of the burgeoning health crisis related to childhood obesity, advertising sugary cereals and fast food to children continues unabated. While cereal companies have promised to self-police the content of their products as well as their advertising, the average child's cereal still packs a full teaspoon of sugar for every 3 teaspoons of cereal, and fast food consumption in general still increases. A spoonful of sugar may help the medicine go down, but it's making childhood obesity rates climb up. Now, a study out of the University of British Columbia has impressive findings on the impact of a long-term ban on fast food advertising for children. Such a ban has been in effect in the province of Quebec, Canada, for over 30 years, and results are pretty clear. Childhood obesity rates in Quebec have steadily declined over that time while they've rocketed up elsewhere. It's estimated that the ban on fast food and junk food advertising to kids in Quebec province has led to a 13% reduction in fast food spending and an estimated reduction of the consumption of 4 billion calories among the province's youth during that time. When the health hazards of drinking and smoking among the youth population were identified, advertising bans were put into place, and that's had a positive impact on youth consumption. A ban on fast food and junk food advertising aimed at children seems like the next logical step. A ban on advertising junk food to kids to curtail their burgeoning consumption of unhealthy foods, now that's a bright idea.
We're speaking today with Dr. Elliot Fisher, Director of Population Health and Policy at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. He is the James W. Squires Professor of Community and Family Medicine at Dartmouth Medical School and is co-chair of a research initiative to study the effectiveness of the Accountable Care Organization in improving access to health care, yielding better outcomes, and reducing cost. Dr. Fisher, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, now we have the Supreme Court decision upholding the Affordable Care Act behind us now, but the real work of implementing the law lies ahead. And at the Dartmouth Institute, you've been advocating for universal access to healthcare for some time now, as well as many other reforms initiated by the Affordable Care Act. What are the key areas in which we are now likely to see the most rapid acceleration of progress and fundamental change?
Well, you know, prediction is really tough, especially about the future, as Niels Bohr said. So it's very hard to predict what the future will hold. But I think there's some things we can say with confidence. The coverage reforms are absolutely critical. We all want to live. I certainly want to live in a country that covers every resident, every American, and makes sure they have access to great health care. And the law makes major steps forward in that direction. And I think the principles underlying it, universal coverage, having everybody purchase insurance so that it's affordable for everybody, and covering, helping pay the cost for those who are too poor to afford it, those principles were adopted by Massachusetts, are underlying the reforms in Vermont. And even if we have a change in the party leading the presidency in the House or Senate, I think we'll see the same direction toward coverage needing to be pushed forward. Where I'm confident that reform is coming is on the changes in the delivery system that will lead to better care and more affordable care that will lower the costs of care. There has been a strong consensus on both sides of the aisle starting, 3 to 5 years ago, that the underlying problems in U.S. healthcare that are driving up costs and leaving quality remarkably uneven and care poorly coordinated, that those underlying problems are recognized, understood, and we'll need to see the changes in payment, changes in delivery, many of which are embedded in the Affordable Care Act, but are also being strongly supported by those outside Congress, from right and from the left.
So, Dr. Fisher, let's focus on that payment system issue for a moment. You and your colleagues at the Institute have long advocated for a revamped payment system. And I think most healthcare leaders will say fee-for-service is outdated, it promotes waste. So you've been studying this potential transformative impact of the Accountable Care Organizations, or ACOs, groups of providers and hospitals working together in the hospital and in the community to cohesively manage care of patients. Tell us about your research at Dartmouth on ACOs. What are you hoping to learn? And maybe a little bit about why the Affordable Care Act called for their specific creation as a vital aspect of the nation's healthcare reform model.
Sure. Well, if we look back a few years, there was this emerging consensus that the underlying cause of a lot of our problems was a fragmented delivery system, which is reinforced by fee-for-service practice. And some of the research we did demonstrated, you know, almost all physicians practice in what natural referral networks around one or a couple of hospitals. They're a group of physicians that refer to each other, usually admit to a common hospital. When you're in the hospital, you know, you refer to the infectious disease specialist or the neurologist that is associated with that hospital. So there are these natural networks that are operating under fee-for-service medicine, not held together by anything more than the informal relationships among the physicians. And we, working with Mark McClellan, former administrator of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, which is an agency that advises Congress about healthcare reform, we started to realize that one could figure out who the patients were associated with each physician, each hospital, each of these natural networks, and then figure out how much it was costing right now to take care of them, and even under fee-for-service, create some incentives for the physicians who are working together informally to work together more coherently and more formally. And if they reduce costs and improve care, they would get a share of the savings and care would be improved for patients. This concept, this notion of accountable care organizations, was embedded in the Affordable Care Act as it passed. And we're now seeing over 150 or so federal accountable care organizations already launched. But very interestingly, we're seeing just as many in the private sector. That is, private health plans like Aetna, Cigna, many of the Blue Cross plans have adopted this model of encouraging docs and hospitals to come together to work toward a common aim, improved care for patients, and then being able to get paid in the same way, largely through fee-for-service, but if they reduce unnecessary utilization, take out wasted services, and achieve savings by improving care, they are financially rewarded. So it's a transitional payment model. It can be adopted in almost every community in the country, and we're seeing that it's adopted in diverse communities across the country. So it's a promising model. What we are doing now is trying to study how well it's being implemented, learn a lot from early implementation. We have some early results, and those are quite promising.
Well, you recently had thought leaders from across the board come together for the National Accountable Care Summit, and you mentioned Dr. McClellan, who is the former CMS and FDA administrator who co-chairs this initiative with you. So tell us about the meeting. And as you look back, is this sort of a seminal gathering with all stars aligned now that the Supreme Court has ruled and the bill is moving forward? And as you just mentioned, HHS has identified a number of ACOs. And talk to us a little bit about your partnership with Dr. McClellan as well.
The difference at this meeting from prior summits was prior years people were talking about it. They were saying, what is an accountable care organization? Mm-hmm. This year, people were saying, well, we've already launched ours. Here's what we're doing. We're finding this is working for our patients. It was much more about we are now learning on the ground how to do this and sharing our insights with each other. The partnership with Dr. McClellan has been absolutely critical to our success. He's a brilliant both administrator and thinker about how Washington works. He's a PhD in economics, so he knows how incentives work. I'm a physician and investigator. He's also a physician, by the way, but the partnership has been very good. His focus largely on how do we get these things implemented in through the policy circles at Washington and in Washington and get people to buy into them. My focus on research and design and understanding the incentives that physicians operate under from our research about how healthcare works across the country. It's been a great partnership.
Well, we would all agree that the goal of the Affordable Care Organizations, better coordinated care, more timely, more patient-centered, better able to reduce or shorten hospital admissions, and we all absolutely agree with. So often people say to us, you know, that sounds an awful lot like the HMO and managed care approach of the 90s. So we'd like to ask you, what's different this time around? one question. A second question, are the ACOs primarily just focused on the Medicare population, or are they relevant to the more general, younger, and healthier patient populations? And if I could squeeze in a third piece to that, I'm so struck by your comment that they build upon the natural network of physicians and hospitals that exist already in the natural relationship there. And I'm curious your thoughts on, are you sure those natural networks still exist as strongly as they once did?
First, the difference between then and now. There are some very important differences. In the old days, health plans, insurers, were largely trying to shift risk to physicians who were not prepared to manage risk. The new model is really about shared risk between insurers, whether it's the federal government on the part of Medicare or private payers such as United, Aetna, Cigna, shared risk. Sound actuarial models where the physician groups and hospitals that have formed an ACO are only held responsible for those costs that they can reasonably be expected to be responsible for. Second huge difference between the old days and the new days is in the old days there were no measures of quality. We did not expect HMOs to improve quality. They weren't quality wasn't even measured. The major thrust with ACOs is transparent quality measurement, and you don't get any share of the savings unless you demonstrate that you're improving the quality of care for the patients you serve. You're making care more accessible. You're making it easier for patients to get into the office after hours. You're improving their blood pressure. You're improving their diabetes if they have those conditions. The third big difference is in the old days, we tended to lock patients in to their HMOs. Patients were not given a choice. The new model is complete freedom of choice. Members are given an option to go wherever they want, but the ACO has pretty strong incentives to help coordinate your care. It goes back to an old Buddhist concept, the best fence is a good pasture. And what we're seeing is accountable care organizations reaching out to say, hey, let me help coordinate your care. So it's a very different model. The old days was about insurers focusing on driving cost changes. The new model is about providers, hospitals and physicians, plans and patients, who are quite engaged in the design of many of these new models. All three of those, providers, plans, and patients, collaborating to improve care. The second, does it have any relevance to the younger population? Well, Massachusetts, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and now other health plans in Massachusetts have already adopted the program for their under 65 populations. The early evidence from that experience is that patients are getting better care. Quality has improved dramatically in the under 65 population. Secretary Leavitt, speaking at our conference, said accountable care is coming, and it's coming in the private sector even more strongly than it's being advanced in the public sector. And finally, this question about natural networks. You know, certainly physicians are not going to the hospital as much, but it's remarkably variable across communities. I think what physicians and hospitals are recognizing is that there is so much opportunity to improve care and lower costs by much more effective coordination to improve care rather dramatically.
We're speaking today with Dr. Elliot Fisher, Director of Population Health and Policy at Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. The Dartmouth Institute is a preeminent research and education institution devoted to the ongoing reform of the U.S. healthcare system. Dr. Fisher is a leading expert on the accountable care organizations. You know, I wanted to talk a little bit about the debate around healthcare reform. Opponents argue that we can't afford to carry the tens of millions of additional uninsured Americans in an already bloated healthcare system. And they claim the measures in the health reform law are going to crush small businesses and cost jobs. And you, as a researcher, when will this Buddhist enlightenment come to to the population so that we can get back to the center and try to get all sides working together to reform a badly needed healthcare system in America?
I would say 10 years ago, anyone talking about cost containment was going to be accused of rationing, of denying beneficial treatments. You know, some of that talk has still been heard, but there's been a strong consensus in the research community. Our own work at Dartmouth, other investigators from McKinsey, the Institute of Medicine, all have agreed that there's about 30% of U.S. healthcare spending that is simply wasted. It's wasted on avoidable unnecessary care. It's wasted on high administrative costs. The place where we're seeing agreement, bipartisan agreement, is on the mechanisms that will allow us to achieve better care and lower costs, moving toward payment systems that reward value over volume. And that sweet spot is what will make healthcare affordable in the longer run, unless we figure out how to take out that 30% of waste, we will not have affordable care for small businesses or large businesses. You know, the argument right now about expanding coverage under the Affordable Care Act and that it will lead to higher costs for businesses is largely around the cost of insurance in a market where healthcare costs have been rising at 10% per year, and requiring everybody to buy into a system where costs have been rising at 10% a year does seem a little scary. But I don't think we'll fix healthcare unless we both cover everybody and do the delivery system reforms we need. Without universal coverage, the easiest way for health plans or businesses to reduce costs is just simply not take care of sick people. And that's not acceptable in my vision of what the United States should be.
Dr. Fisher, let me focus on those patients once again. One of the pillars of your research goals at the Dartmouth Institute, I believe, is on empowering patients and helping to facilitate patients and making informed decisions about their own health care. Tell us how the Accountable Care Organizations work to empower patients to be better informed stewards of their own care.
Well, there are a number of initiatives in the Affordable Care Act, and the ACOs are one, that are really trying to promote patient engagement in managing their care, their own health, more effectively, and in making wiser choices about the major treatment decisions they face. So ACOs have incentives to, keep people healthy. You know, once you have high blood pressure or diabetes or you're overweight, the person who needs to take care of you is yourself and your family members, because chronic illness is a daily problem of being engaged in your own care. And ACOs have a strong incentive to help individuals improve their health. The second really important area of the Affordable Care Act that we've been involved with, just received a large award from the Center for Innovation at Medicare to implement programs around the country on what we call shared decision making. You know, many patients faced with an important clinical decision, such as an elective angioplasty for coronary artery disease, that is, if you have chest pain caused by a blockage of your artery, there's some choices that you face. If you don't have an acute heart attack, it's an elective procedure to have a little tube put in, the clot pushed out of the way. But that's an elective choice. Most Americans looking at that choice think that their life is being saved by the procedure. It's not. It doesn't reduce their risk of death. It doesn't even reduce their risk of a heart attack. It slightly improves their symptoms. If you care about, improving your function and not having any chest pain, maybe you want a stent, but you should understand that there's a lifetime of medication that you have to take after having that stent. When we adopt these programs of informed patient decision-making, what we see is patients make decisions that are much more aligned with their own preferences. And what we end up avoiding is wrong patient surgery. If you received a procedure that you, if well-informed, would not have wanted, that's just as bad as wrong side surgery. That's wrong patient surgery. And these new programs that help patients make wise choices, maybe I can do just as well with medication and behavior change. Those are really important decisions that patients need to make. And some of the reforms in the Affordable Care Act and in many of states are going to help patients make those decisions and become much more engaged in their care.
Dr. Fisher, you've talked a lot about the importance of the collection of data, its importance in the model of care delivery that we have. Tell us a little bit about how technology and data systems are going to help us achieve that goal.
But there are probably two important ways that they will help us. First is these tools, whether they're on smartphones or web applications, are going to allow patients to become engaged in their own care in very important new ways. Some of the more innovative health systems have adopted patient portals that allow us, allow a patient to complete a health risk appraisal, understand what behaviors they have and what they're doing and what they can do to improve their health. So I think the tools will become much more patient-friendly. Similar tools will enable patients to work with their physicians or with a health coach by email, by Skype, and get help from their physician or from their physician's practice without having to take a half day off and go sit in a waiting room. The second use of the data systems, and we're finding this to be very important, is that they will help us better understand how our own healthcare systems are doing and what can be done within that healthcare system to improve care. We will find opportunities because one practice is doing a better job at keeping people healthy than another. We can learn from those differences that the other physicians in their community can learn from.
Dr. Fisher, we like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and around the world, what do you see in terms of innovations that our listeners at Conversations should be keeping an eye on?
Oh, one of the most exciting things I'm seeing is the emergence of a community engagement in managing the future of their healthcare system. An initiative of the Fannie Ripple Foundation called Rethink Health has in five communities around the country at least started to bring diverse stakeholders together, from community members to hospital leaders to business leaders, to start to have a conversation about what is it going to take in our community to improve the health of all of our residents and to lower costs for all of us. Those conversations are starting to lead to promising insights. You know, can we use community organizing as a way of engaging patients in taking back their own health and their healthcare system? You know, if you look at the early success of Grand Junction in Colorado, what they achieved, you know, one of the lowest cost communities in the country, this was a community-wide initiative led by the physicians. Hospitals quickly joined, businesses became involved. One thing we've learned at Dartmouth from our studies of variations is that health and healthcare are both produced locally. What that means is that we as community members are going to have to engage in leading the change within our healthcare systems, and we see promising signs that that is starting to happen.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Elliot Fisher, Director of Population Health and Policy at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. Dr. Fisher, thank you so much for joining us today at Conversations on Healthcare.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report. The two recent wars have left tens of thousands of American soldiers with some pretty damaged bodies, their sacrifice spurring on new areas of research, though, that could have some long-term implications for health care for everyone. The U.S. Armed Forces has been making advances in medical technology to keep up with the needs of wounded vets, many of whom have devastating wounds to limbs and the torso that are in the least disfiguring and at worst immobilizing. Researchers at Wake Forest University have developed a technique where they can actually grow muscle tissue in the lab that they say is then implantable. Are we talking about the making of a new class of Terminators with supplemental biceps? Well, for the time being, no. But they're hoping to use this new technique to restore muscle to soldiers with severe head and neck injuries. Typically, patients suffering severe muscle damage can only be repaired by taking muscle from one part of the body to another, kind of like robbing from Peter to pay Paul. In a paper published in the latest issue of Tissue Engineering Part A, researchers at the Armed Forces Telemedicine and Advanced Technology Center, along with scientists from Wake Forest University, detail how they grew the muscle tissue using muscle cells from mice and a pig bladder. Dr. George Crist, professor of regenerative medicine at Wake Forest University, explains that by exercising this growing strip of muscle in the lab, they train it to behave as a muscle would.
Then we put them in the bioreactor for about 5 days, and we stretch them about 10%, three times a minute for the first 5 minutes of every hour, basically. Like if you were doing curls or push-ups or upright rows or something, the equivalent of basically just letting the cells know they're being stretched, but not stretching them so much we're kind of tearing them apart.
The growing muscle also has stem cells added to it during the exercise phase and growing process, rapidly increasing the cell's development.
What we did was remove 50% of the latissimus dorsi muscle, which is the muscle on the back of a mouse, same thing as a person, remove 50 to 60% of that muscle and put this construct in its place. So we're creating what for a mouse obviously is a huge injury. And we place this in there, and within 2 months, they've regained 75% of their normal contractile ability.
Theirs and other labs also working to engineer new implantable blood vessels, bone, and skin. Kind of a brave new world for tissue regeneration. He says they plan to test the muscle-growing transplanting technique on humans requiring cleft palate corrections. The FDA could have an answer within a few months. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.